Welcome to the weekend. Each week I invite a keynote Sandler trainer to discuss strategies to improve behavior, attitude, and techniques using the highly successful Sandler training system. This week our guest is Sandler trainer Josh Seibert. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be aboard.
I'm really thrilled to have Josh on the show today for several reasons. One is, in the Sandler worlds, Josh is a bit of a legend. He's the winner of the David H. Sandler Award, which is the most coveted award in our network. And Josh is also the author of a new book that has just come out. It's called Winning from Failing. So, Josh, give us a brief overview of what inspired you to write this book.
What inspired me to write the book? It's a question that I'm asked a lot of times, Jim. And what inspired me to write the book is over 20 years worth of doing this with Sandler, training and developing clients from over a 20-year span. It's the feedback that I've gotten from those customers, those clients. And the feedback is, gosh, if I'd only known the value of this training beyond what I thought the value of it was, it'd be great. Why can't you tell people how good this is before we get started?
That is so true. But it's a little bit counter Sandler to tell people about the features and benefits, because we talk primarily about what is the compelling reason you would have to even want to explore a relationship with Sandler. Fair?
Yeah, it's not only fair, it's true. And the learning and the real learning that happens throughout the life cycle of a client really doesn't happen. And you can't state it from a features and benefits perspective. Everybody has their own nugget, their own crown jewel that they gain from this. So what I did was I took it and elevated it to a corporate level. And the book is really about building a corporate learning culture for high performance. And that's the reason that I wrote the book. So that goes beyond what we do and goes to our why. Simon Sinek has written some great things about our why. And this is our why and how we have to connect that with the why of our customers and our clients.
When I first joined the Sandler process, the concept of winning through failing was foreign to me. In fact, I remember having a conversation with my father, who he was a lifelong learner and a salesperson. And when I told him that we learn through failing, he about had a heart attack, because for him, failure is a four-letter word, never fail. So help us get past that head trash that we might have about how could we win through failing?
Well, we all know that we win much more, we learn much more from failure than we do from successes. Successes we tend to celebrate. We strive for those, and we oftentimes don't succeed the first time. And we've learned the things like, if you first don't succeed, then try again, because we learn, the continual learning process is from failing. And if we don't embrace that as a learning culture, then we really never grow. Mm. We only celebrate. And growth is what we're all about.
So I think it's, what is it they say, no pain, no gain. It's the pain of failing that really strikes home the learning that can help us get out of our current comfort zone into a new practice, a new behavior. So give us an overview of the book. Talk us through what might a reader be experiencing as they crack open your book.
Well, once again, the end result and the purpose of this is to build and lead a corporate learning culture for high performance. If you're going to do that, there's standards and processes to be able to do that. I wrote the book based on my personal experiences and how they blend with what we do with and for corporations and companies and individuals. And what you would experience from the book is my personal experience through my life as a United States Navy submarine sailor for about 6 years, and my experiences as a manager and developer in the world of professional financial services with Prudential Financial. So what I share throughout the book is my failures and what I've learned through that process of failing. And if I had to do anything over again, you know, the proverbial question, if you could ever do anything over again, what would it be that you would do over again? I would fail quicker and embrace failure more quickly, so that I didn't suffer as long as I had to suffer to get to where I am today. The purpose of the book is to build a learning culture that embraces failure and actually goes beyond embracing failure and actually challenges you to cause failure quick enough such that you can get the growth section, that meat on the bone, a whole lot quicker than most people do by trying to prevent or avoid failure at all costs.
It's challenging to even think about that, actually trying to fail. But if you think about failure, in fact, My rule of thumb for failing is fail fast, fail often, and all new failures. If you're repeating the same failure over and over again, that's just stupidity. Right.
Well, you just capsulized the book in about 3 or 4 words, so we're probably through.
I don't think so. Yeah, and the whole thought of having to push myself into a situation where I'm failing, I think is foreign to a lot of people, but if you really think about it, that's how the cycle of life works. What have you found in your experience in training corporations and helping develop that corporate learning culture? What's the biggest obstacle you see keeping people stuck in a comfort zone?
Yeah, the biggest challenge comes from the level of the organization that wants training and development to begin with. And it's the challenge of onboarding and getting on board management. Leadership and management of an organization are a critical component to building a learning culture. Without management and management first and developed managers, the three-legged stool tends to fall over because one of the strongest legs of the stool is that leadership and management leg. So what we found is that over a life cycle, we all find that training becomes tactical. It's a tactical tool to the end, but standalone, it will not cause learning to happen. And if learning doesn't happen as a result of training and development, then we lose the value of training in the long run. So one of the biggest challenges is to get organizations to not only recognize and realize that management is a crucial component of that learning path, but we also need to start with management first.
So the managers have to be willing to themselves acknowledge that they might need to learn. They might need to lead by example. And I don't know if this has been your experience, but many managers tend to do what I call war story training. Their training is all about the way I would do this and what you should do is. And I think that's the ineffective approach of telling people what to do because they don't hear it. They haven't experienced it. Your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly true. We all hope that everyone can learn from our experiences. So we tell the stories. You know, when I did it, when my experience happened, this is what I felt and this is what I experienced. So hopefully you don't have to go through the same thing that I went through. You'll just learn from me telling you. And telling is not training. Yeah. So managers are very busy. They're busy supervising. They're busy trying to get results. The pressure is on. Their development as a manager and the other leadership roles of manager, other than that supervising and doing, that coach role, that mentor role, it's very challenging for them to find the time and find the payoff, the immediate payoff. Pressure is on and the pressure is there to get some immediate payoff. We want ROI today and hopefully all the rest of it will be learned along the way. When in reality, managers in management leadership, the role is to get productivity, effective and efficient productivity through others, not from others. And to do that, they themselves have to be better coaches, better mentors, better trainers in that challenge for them not to be the super salesperson for their team or to be the troubleshooter and firefighter for their team. And they find themselves boxed in because they themselves have never been trained and developed as good mentors or coaches.
Yeah, it's not uncommon to start working with a company and find out that the manager will say something like, I don't know why nobody can think on their own. They're always coming to me and asking me what I should do. And so my question is, so of course you must be telling them what to do. Well, yeah. And are they afraid they might not do it the way you want it? Could that be why they keep coming to you? So we build this almost addiction that our employees have to us because we don't let them fail. So isn't one of the first steps is creating an environment as a manager where it's safe for your people to fail?
We must not only embrace that, we must behave in that manner as well. So allowing first the mindset of allowing failure to happen and the value of failure in the long run is much more than the immediacy of the benefit of the short run. The short run is fix the problem, put the fire out and step in and take charge by doing for them. And we feel that immediate result. You know, we're in this society today that is demanding an immediate result. We want it today. We want it now. And point click, we have it, right? So managers today are expecting that we can point click and get an immediate result where we can do that, but it's not lasting. It's not sustainable without that manager or that person behaving in the wrong manner. It's very difficult to get those results or to believe that we can get those results more effectively by allowing learning to happen. And it only happens by experiencing not only the success of the result, result, but the failures along the way so that they're not repeated. Like you said, Jim, I want people to fail quickly and fail often and quickly so that they don't repeat it.
Yeah, it's awesome. My guest today is author Josh Seibert. Josh is the author of the book Winning from Failing. Josh, give your contact information and share with our guests how they might get a copy of your book.
Well, they can get a copy of the book off of the website, training.sandler.com. That's our website, training.sandler.com. You can find out a lot of information about me, my team, what we do here in North Carolina. But you can also go to the top and it says shop. And when you shop, there's the book. You'll find it, Winning from Failing, along with many other wonderful books that Sandler has put out. You can also go to Amazon.com and look up Winning from Failing, and there will be the book. It's available on Amazon, both in hard copy and in digital form.
Thank you, Josh. I'm Idaho's Sandler trainer, Jim Stevens. Visit our website at www.crossroads.sandler.com and download our free booklet, Why Salespeople Fail and What You Can Do About It. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Welcome to Entrepreneur Radio, where we get to hear the stories and learn more about my heroes in society, independent business owners and leaders. I'm Jim Stevens with Sandler Training, and I've invited my wife, Joan Stevens, my most favorite person on the planet, who is also the president of our remodeling company, Stronghold Remodeling. Welcome, Joan. Glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
What I love about Entrepreneur Radio is we get to share some of the strategies and challenges that have led to success from people who have learned by trial and error. And by hearing some of their stories and the lessons of peers, I think it's a great way to find out how we can grow and develop not only personally, but as a business. So Joan, Stronghold Remodeling really started in what, 1981 or two? We were incorporated in 89?
85.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a story of the early days in Stronghold Remodeling.
Well, we kind of started that company on accident, I would say. That was how we were paying the bills. And when we first came to Idaho in the late 70s, there was quite a depression going on in the state, and it wasn't easy to find a job. And Jim started doing painting and small remodeling jobs, and then that kind of grew and grew and grew. Jim, if you don't know him, is a bit of a perfectionist, so he makes sure he does everything just right, and people like that in remodeling. And as time went on, we found ourselves with 40 some full-time employees and doing a lot of remodeling, and we found that we didn't really know what we didn't know, and we didn't know how to become more efficient and effective. So we started looking for ways to do that.
And one of the ways that we learned to grow is through a local association called the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. Stronghold Remodeling is one of the charter members. That association is still thriving today.
Yeah, you'll find it under the Idaho Remodelers Association of NARI, N-A-R-I.
Probably by the late 80s, we were doing, Joan and I were doing some speaking on national circuits at trade shows about remodeling and being business partners and married in business. And through that process, we got exposed to the National Association of the Remodeling Industry's main trade show. And Joan became first the regional vice president, and then tell them the story about your growth from there.
Well, I served as the regional vice president for the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, for 3 years. And then I moved into the national officers and went through all, I think there were 7 seats at that time, secretary, treasurer. We had 3 vice presidents, then president and chairman of the board. So I had the privilege of going through all those seats. I spent probably a good 10 years as part of the leadership of the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, which was huge. It was a wonderful experience.
Joan learned a lot and was surrounded by a lot of remodeling contractors who were really doing well in their business. We were doing well, but we weren't making a lot of money. And some of the folks that were on the board with her, they were very successful and they were making a lot of money. And the more we interviewed them to find out what set them apart, we realized the number one common denominator was Sandler training.
Some of the things we found out about in Sandler training was a better and more efficient way to communicate. And between in remodeling, there are so many little details and there's so many people. If you're using subcontractors who are experts in their field, tile, drywall, electrical, plumbing, then you have your homeowner, you have your employees, you've got a lot of details that you have to get to a lot of people. And so what we found was communication is so huge. And through our involvement with Sandler, with our remodeling company, we were able to put that into a specialized communication system that we used with our clients, with our subs, with our employees to keep everybody on the same page. And it made a huge difference in our ability to perform the jobs well, to stay on schedule, to make sure everybody knows what's going on.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think communication is one of the least developed skill sets in our culture. In fact, if you ask a group of people, how many of you would say you're above average communicators? Most people will raise their hand, which of course can't be.
Yeah, we all think we're pretty good at it.
And so with just some of the communication tools that we were learning, we learned how to better serve our clients, better serve our employees, and really help get to an outcome that was mutually beneficial for everyone in the remodeling world. Take us through some of the lessons you've learned, Joan, in your 30 plus years running Stronghold Remodeling.
Happy to do that. I would say one lesson is to use the experts. A lot of people will use a jack of all trades, master of none, to do their project. And unfortunately, it ends up taking more time and they don't get as good of a final product. And so it's important, I believe, to make sure you're calling in the experts. They do it all day, every day, and they're good at it. So they have efficiencies that you don't get if you only do it once in a while.
And the proof of that is in our first few years of learning how to run a business, we were experimenting on our clients. We didn't charge much back then, right? It was a bargain for our clients, but we were learning. And there comes a point where you've made every mistake and you've learned from them. And that expertise is hard fought for and hard won.
And a lot of the business books you'll read today will echo that good to great. You've got to get the right people on the bus. You've got to get the right people doing the job in the first place. You need to have a great engineer. If you're getting design work done, you want to have a great designer. You want to have the best of the best if you want to have a great project.
A lot of homeowners work hard to do it themselves, which is a viable option. I think one of the challenges there is if you're trying to run subcontractors and engineers and you're only going to do one project over the next X number of years, they don't often put you on the front burner. They tend to favor people who give them most of their work. Talk us through that process.
Right. That is true, especially as the economy is now in Boise and Meridian areas. People are busy. And if you call someone, you may have to wait a while to get the person that you want to do your job. Or you can keep calling and find someone who says they'll do it, but maybe they really don't have that much experience in it. So you're sometimes the speed of getting it done in your timeline, sometimes that has to become your deciding factor, but you should think about that pretty long and hard before you make that decision.
Yeah, you can't get the fastest project, the highest quality, and the lowest price.
Impossible.
Impossible to get all three of those. You're going to have to give up something. And so talk us through the philosophy of Stronghold Remodeling, because you made a choice early on that we were not going to be the cheapest.
Right. In order to use the people who are experts at what they do, and in order to have good people on staff, it's important to pay them a living wage. Frankly, back in the day when we started, when we first moved to Boise, we were living in a mobile home in a campground.
Right.
Our expenses were pretty low, so we didn't have to charge much. But at some point, we actually wanted to have health insurance for our family and wanted to actually live in a home,
right.
Which necessitated raising some prices. And certainly it's not to gouge anyone or to take advantage of people, but it is a craft. And what happens in remodeling that's different from new construction is remodeling ends up with a lot of thinking time, of figuring out time. And it's not always cut and dried on what's going to be the best solution in an existing home with existing walls, and maybe things aren't square, maybe things aren't level. Figuring out the best way to do things takes a little extra time, and time is money.
Yeah, we realized early on that if we were going to attract great employees, we had to have something other than wages to offer them, some security. In fact, we paid for not only our employees' health insurance, but their entire family, and that is a significant investment. And of course, all of those decisions are going to reflect quality of the finished product, because you've got people who are devoted to their clients and devoted to their company, and they really want to make a difference. Now, Joan, you're a CR. What does that CR stand for?
That is a designation from the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, and it stands for Certified Remodeler. So back in, I believe it was 1995, we took an 8-hour exam that went over all facets of remodeling, and that's how we became certified. We also had to fill out an extensive resume and curriculum vitae of projects we had done, other endorsements from vendors, clients, suppliers, subcontractors, people we had worked with. And NARI put together that certification because there are a lot of people who have done do-it-yourself projects and believe that they are certainly qualified. A remodeler, qualified to some extent, and they are to some extent. But oftentimes people don't want that handyman look, that I did it myself look. I've noticed that when people do it themselves, they're a lot more forgiving with mistakes, things not quite right.
Yeah, that's true. And by the way, if it's not your full-time job, how do you even know if it's not right?
Well, that's a good point.
You
most
may not
people
even
don't.
Know. Right?
Most people
and
don't.
So you go take a class at Home Depot and you just assume that what they told you must be the right way, or you watch a YouTube video.
And it's not that it's not the right way. What hits me on those is if you haven't done it before, you don't know the right questions to ask. It's almost like they're speaking in another language. And certainly with time and effort put into it, you can make it a great project. And my hat's off to all the do-it-yourselfers out there. There's fabulous projects done by them. But there is a difference between a do-it-yourselfer and a professional.
So talk to us. I'd like to hear your opinion on some of the TV shows that are popular.
Oh, don't get me started.
Design on a Dime. And...
Well, I watch those and shake my head because, you know, cameras can do interesting things to photos.
Right.
You'll see that if you've ever looked online for a hotel or a B&B, and when you got there, you knew that it was the same place, but it looked amazingly different and not in a good way.
Right.
And most of those design shows that you see, they are not counting in any cost of labor. So they're talking about material costs, which tend to be maybe 15 to 20% of projects.
And they, oftentimes those are comped by a supplier.
They
or
are.
Vendor.
So they come up with these prices that are, wow, they're scary low because they are not counting any labor typically.
And you have a publication that you often send to clients or people who are interested in remodeling to help them understand a little bit about what they can expect pricing wise. Mm-hmm. Share with the listeners what that document is and how they might go about getting a copy of that from you.
Absolutely. It's called the Cost versus Value Remodeling Report. It's put out by Remodeling Magazine, which is a national magazine. They take averages from remodelers all across the country. In fact, they break it up in regions of the country, and they can tell you the average price. So they can get those prices from building departments, when people are pulling permits, things like that is where they get their data. And then they go ahead and tell you, if this is the cost, how much of that can you recoup within, say, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. And it is an average. You know, there's a lot of projects that are more, there's a lot that are less. And so many things, if you think about it in remodeling, from your light switch to your molding to your doorknob to your light fixture to your cabinetry, everything you are going to select, there is a range from low grade, medium, high grade. And when you take that into account on every single item that you're purchasing, there's a huge difference between projects.
Right. And that publication will break them down by kitchen, by...
Bathrooms. Bathrooms are really popular. And the biggest value you get back is from kitchens, kitchen projects, and bathroom projects in resale value.
Mm-hmm.
So if you'd like a copy of that report, you can email me, Joan, J-O-A-N, at strongholdremodeling.com, and I'd be happy to send that out to you.
That's Joan at strongholdremodeling.com. So, Joan, what other strategies, tactics, or lessons have you learned that you've been able to put to work in serving your clients in Stronghold?
One of the tactics that we found was systems. And if you've ever read, if you're an entrepreneur, if you haven't read it, you need to read The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, which is all about systems and systematizing what you do. And what we did was take our processes like selecting things. So we needed to have a whole process from the homeowners dreaming of it to us helping them pick it out and then documenting it and getting that to the right people who needed to know that information when they were actually doing the project. And so we ended up making a little process and system and a chart of how to do that, who needed to get it, all that type of thing. Another thing that we did was lien releases. Now, lien releases are required. If you request a lien release from any contractor that you're working with, they are required to provide those for you. And a lien release gives you the knowledge that when they have been paid by you, that they have paid their bills. So no one can come back on you 6 months later and say, excuse me, I'm the plumber. No one ever paid me for my plumbing. I'm putting a lien on your house and you're going to pay me again. Because even though you paid the subcontractor never paid their supplier. And so lien releases are a pretty big thing. It's important that you get them.
So you recommend that every homeowner request lien releases so
Absolutely.
That they protect themselves.
You really should.
And then talk to us about what is your license number with the city?
Okay. In the state of Idaho, there is a registration for contractors. There's not licensing in the state of Idaho, but there is registration. And if you have a registered contractor, they'll have a number. Ours is RCE81. Right now, we got that when they first started registration. We were one of the first ones to get it. I was very proud of that. And now they're in the, I think, 18,000s. And that's license. Maybe been 20 years. So that tells you that there is a lot of turnover in construction in the state of Idaho. So if you get a registered contractor, that proves a couple things. It proves they have liability insurance, because you can't get that registration without liability insurance. And it proves that if they have employees, that they're covered by workers' comp, and it gives them the right to lien you if you don't pay them. So while it's not a license to do work like you would see in California, it is a registration. You can look it up online, and I suggest you do that. And you can tell by that registration number how long someone has been around.
So Joan, give your contact information in case one of our listeners is intrigued and would like to have a conversation with you, or perhaps somebody out there is thinking of doing a remodeling project and would like to have your company provide them some advice.
My contact information is, you can call us at 208-345-7154, or you can email me, Joan, J-O-A-N, at strongholdremodeling.com. We have a website. It's strongholdremodeling.com. We'd be happy to talk to you.
Thank you, Joan. On Entrepreneur Radio, we share the stories of leaders and individuals who drive change to see how they've achieved success. If you'd like our content, visit our website at crossroads.sandler.com and see how we can help you. So far, I've been speaking with Sandler trainer Josh Seibert, and he's going to take us into a little more detail about the book he has written, Winning from Failing. Some of the things we talked about in our first segment was how most of us win through failing because that's how we learn, but it is not how we train. So if I'm going to learn through failing, it seems logical to me, Josh, that I probably should extend to my employees, the folks I manage, the same courtesy, winning through failing. How do I get past that roadblock that I can't afford to let them fail?
Yeah, it's a difficult roadblock to overcome, but it must be overcome. So I would recommend, first and foremost, let's start with ourselves, giving ourselves permission to fail in the world of getting productivity through others. So we have to first forgive ourselves for giving them the opportunity. We have to release that ourselves if they're going to believe that we can release it for them. We have to give them safe places to fail. So for example, in our training room, when someone is demonstrating or working on a new skill, we have to cause failure and allow it to happen in a controlled environment first, because we're never going to do it in live fire until we can see ourselves doing it in a controlled environment. So step one, allow yourself and allow those folks that you are developing to fail in a controlled environment. We can expect failure in a controlled environment because there's no risk. There's very low risk. The only thing we risk is vulnerability and pride, and those things can be overcome in a controlled environment. So if you can't do it in a live fire first, then do it in that controlled environment. For example, when someone first learns a skill, a 30-second commercial, a questioning technique, put them to task to take that knowledge, that newfound knowledge, and attempt it in a controlled environment with a role play where it's all set up and everyone realizes that you're going to stop before someone loses a sale. There's no one buying from you in a sales training group instruction environment anyway, so it's fairly safe to do, and it's okay, and give permission to stop and to fail and to begin again. That's how we condition ourselves that it's first and foremost okay to fail, because it's very low risk. And secondly, think about taking that same skill set to the field. That's where it really gets risky. Oh my goodness, I don't want to try this in the field. What if my salesperson fails and they don't get the sale? First and foremost, do not be there to rescue them. Allow them to experience that failure without you rescuing them. Use it on a safe call. Certainly a newfound skill, we don't want to take the risk of polishing that skill on our best client or our best opportunity this year. What we want to do is use it in that world of cold calling. Heck, sometimes we, for example, we use a questioning skill on the waitress at the restaurant that we're going to go and then give her a big tip, for crying out loud. You know, there are safe places that we can exercise and adapt and apply this newfound knowledge so as to not sink the ship. Remember, failure is okay if it's not catastrophic. So let's not set it up to be a catastrophic failure, but failures that can be recovered from. You know, there's a list of what we call training calls. That's that list of cold calls. There's a reason that we make cold calls, for example, in the world of sales. Yes, they lead to warmer calls and hotter calls and maybe customers. Ultimately, we learn that referrals, for example, are a much better initiated call than a cold call out of a list. Mm-hmm. But the value of the list of the cold calls that we make allows that individual, that salesperson, to exercise newfound knowledge for developing skills without the risk of losing a wonderful opportunity. We call them training calls.
Yeah.
So put environments together to allow and expect failure, and it's a whole lot easier to get over the hurdle of, oh my goodness, failure is defined as not getting the one sale that we need to accomplish our budget for the year.
Yeah, I know. Great point. One of the things that you said earlier in the program, Josh, is that training tends to be very tactical. And I think, frankly, that's what we start with, is let's practice a new tactic, a new strategy. In Sandler, we have things like using the thermometer close, or using a 30-second commercial to find pain, or a strong upfront contract to establish equal business stature. And to your point, if I'm not practicing it in a safe place, it'll never become second nature enough for me to actually use it in the field. I had a client once who, she was a client for probably 3 or 4 years, and in training, she was awesome. And she came to me one day and said, you know, Jim, I've decided that I'm going to close my business. And I said, well, why would you do that? And she said, well, it's just not being successful. And I said, you're one of our best role players. And she said, yeah, but I just can't do it in front of clients. Right? And it's like, really? You can't do it in front of clients? You're awesome in training, but you got to get to that place where you take it beyond the training room and actually execute it, which is where the rubber meets the road.
Sure. You know, we have a saying that you're very familiar with, Jim, that go for no. Go for no is a paradigm shift for salespeople. So for someone to take it from a training room to a practical application in the field, they have to be prepared for what you're looking for is failure as you define it. No's are always defined as failure before they come and train with us, right?
Right.
No one wants to get a no, so they do everything in the world to avoid and defend against that no. And as you know, a learning culture says that you're going to get more no's than you're going to get yeses. Salespeople were hired to go out and get rejected.
Mm-hmm.
When they get right with that, there's a no goal that we must establish to allow them to experience the failures that they're going to experience before they find that no. And not only embrace the no's, but expect the no's through setting goals for getting rejection, getting no's. So we want you to go out and try these such that I need to see that you've gotten 10 no's along with that yes. The yes is great. We want to see you get the yes. But unless you get me 10 no's, I'm not satisfied. So the paradigm shift for the manager is set those no goals so that we've now placed a safe environment in the field for the salesperson to actually exercise these skills, because I need you to get those no's
right,
as well as that yes that you're looking for.
Yeah, those no's strengthen your spine. It helps you get past your own fear of rejection. In fact, I had a client who I thought this was a brilliant assignment. He gave his, I think he had like six salespeople, and they lived in a fairly small community. He said, look, I want each of you to go out and collect 100 business cards. And on the back of each business card, I want you to have the business person write, I will never use your services. Just get them to write that on the back of their business card, and I'm going to give everybody $100. And so, of course, what they found out is if you ask somebody to say, I will never, they don't want to say that, which automatically starts to warm them up. So it was hard to get 100 no's, but once they all got 100 no's, they traded cards and had the other person go back and say, so why won't you ever use our services? It's a great gut
practice. That's a wonderful
practice.
Exercise, and it illustrates just what we're talking about. That's setting up for a minor failure to get the behaviors to start happening. See, we initiate learning in the knowledge atmosphere. We have knowledge transfer in a training room, and that's where it begins. And then that application and adaptation part has to happen. So we begin that demonstration of a learned skill in a controlled environment such as a training room. But if it never leaves that training room and doesn't go to the field with innovative thought and strategy such as what you've just demonstrated, then we don't build those skills. Skills aren't built in a training center. They're reinforced in a training center. They're actually built when we experience what happens when we use it in varying ways in the field. So we adapt and we apply it multiple times. We bring it back and reinforce the learning in the training center. And through that process, skills are developed such that we aren't thinking anymore about the skill. We're just using it. When that skill becomes the behavior, the habit, we're no longer thinking. It's now muscle memory. And unless we allow that failure to happen along the way, to put those boundaries around our behavior and the techniques, unless we allow that happen, it just never goes to the behavioral change on a sustainable manner. So you've hit the nail on the head. You've got to develop exercises and spaces to allow that failure to happen, and you have to expect it. And by setting no goals is a very, very fine example of expecting failure to happen with the expectation that the salesperson or the learner will come back with those failures as well as the successes along the way. We've always said that if you're a heat-seeking missile for pain,
yes,
you're going to find more pain than you'll find by just looking for people with pleasure.
Right.
Because you're out there looking for failure. You're looking for no's. You're trying to sweep the chaff away from that, the real seeds that are out there. The seeds are going to get in the way of the exercise.
Yeah.
You're looking for no's, and people are going to shock you with yes, and I will, and no, I won't give you a no, as you've illustrated. Managers have to be challenged, and they've got to get their head right with creating an expectation of failure.
My guest today is Josh Seibert. Josh, give your contact information. By the way, those of you that might be interested in getting a copy of Josh's book, it's entitled Winning from Failing. It's Sandler Publication. Share with our listeners how they might get a copy of your book.
Well, you can get a hold of me and get a copy of the book by going to my website, and that's training.sandler.com. You can contact us with the contact information that's on that site. You can also find my book on that site in the shop. So when you go to training.sandler.com, just go to the shop and my book, Winning from Failing, is there, along with a multitude of books that are very valuable for everything that you want to do in the Sandler Network.
Thanks, Josh. I'm Idaho's CEO of Sandler Training, Jim Stevens. If you like the show and want to subscribe to our content, visit us at crossroads.sandler.com/podcast or reach out at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Josh, so far we've been talking about some of the conceptual aspects of how do I win through failing. In this segment, I'd like you to give us some, maybe some specific examples that you've experienced either personally or you've experienced vicariously through your clients of how they found a real breakthrough through failing. And maybe to help put the ball on the tee, let's kick it off by, we're talking about managers. It's important that you lead the way. What are the top 3 to 5 most important skill sets you think a manager needs to be helping their constituents learn in order to be successful?
Well, certainly what they're helping their constituents to learn is fall in three different categories. We use them all the time, and they're the three points of the success triangle. As we train at Sandler, there are attitudinal competencies that must be developed and learned by your salespeople, your constituents. The attitudinal are very important. What I don't mean there is just a simple positive attitude. We're going to get them. We're never going to fail. What I'm talking about is building a high self-esteem and self-worth. The self-image of a successful salesperson is impenetrable. It is rejection-proof, as it were.
Yeah.
For those who don't succeed in the world of sales, that is damaged in some way. There's not the space suit
right.
That's protecting that self-image, self-esteem. As we talked about before, salespeople are hired to go out and get rejected, because if it was easy as just going out and sweeping up all the sales, they would be called collectors and not salespeople.
Good point. It's a great point.
The area that we have to develop in salespeople are the attitudinal competencies that separate their identity from their role. And that's very, very important. The second area is certainly the behavioral area, the ability for a salesperson to write, develop their own goals. And those are the reasons why they want to be successful in that world of sales, why they will drive productivity, why they will bring in the revenue. Is frankly, they won't do it for the manager for very long if it's for the managers of the corporate reasons, but they'll do it for their reasons much, right. much longer. Right. So a manager being able to connect the dots with the company, the corporate goals, and what motivates that sales manager, what are the goals of that salesperson, and why that salesperson will perform, allowing to take those goals and developing a good plan of action. And a good plan is not just do more.
Right.
It's having a good strategy and a good cookbook as to what works really well for that particular salesperson in the sales organization, and to help them take action and put that action to practice, and helping them behaviorally on that B side of the behavior side of the triangle. And last but not least is technically proficient. Help that salesperson have the skills and have the energy and the personal presence and the strategies necessary from a sales system perspective to be able to execute upon that. Everybody needs muscle memory. Everyone needs a place to go when support is not there. Sales can be very lonely. You're on your own. And that ability to call upon a successful and dependable selling system with techniques that are just second nature and their muscle memory, with that personal professional presence, that's leadership. All
yes.
salespeople need to be competent leaders before anything. So if a manager focuses on the attitudes, the behaviors, and the techniques necessary for that salesperson to succeed, they're going to be focusing on getting business through that developed and that growing individual as opposed to from them.
Let's take a very practical approach and let's look at one of the most crippling diseases that salespeople face, and that is fear of rejection. And maybe its ugly twin sister or brother is need for approval. I need people to like me, therefore I end up making me the center of attention. I don't like to be rejected, so I spend time with people who won't reject me, and that just isn't going to help me grow my business. So how do I take that attitude that I have and use your formula for winning from failing and overcome that crippling belief system?
Well, this is a unique example. I'm glad you brought that up. David Sandler once was quoted in saying, sales is a Broadway show put on by psychiatrists. And it's a part of what we call separating our identity from our roles. If we have the ability, and we must train on a regular basis, to be able to separate who we are from who we are, as we say. Our identity is who we are, stripped of all of our roles. And from that, we're developed internally, and we have this thing that we've acquired over a lifetime, is our level of need for approval, our need to be loved as a human being and what that is. And sometimes we confuse those values, those needs, with our performance in our roles.
Right.
Much better for a performer in a movie or on a stage to be able to take themselves out of who they are as an individual and put themselves in that role. We see them as viewers of that movie, that great movie, your most favorite movie.
Yeah.
We idolize that figure on the stage. But when you peel the onion back, the actor that performed that role is nothing like that person in that role.
Right.
Yet they perform that role with experience and expertise such that they get Oscars for performing that role. We as salespeople, or our constituents as it were, the salespeople that work for us have to develop their spacesuit. When they put themselves in the role of sales professional, they've got to be able to leave their identity behind.
Right.
and protect that identity from how they're being treated in the role as a salesperson. They're like the actor on a stage. When they put on that suit, when they pick up that briefcase, they're in a professional role, and they must maintain the professionalism in that role of leadership and respect. Right. And that's the role that they must be performing so that they can take that high need for approval, for example, and park it, because that person in that role doesn't need the approval. Only the individual needs the approval, and they can get that approval elsewhere through their family life, through their spiritual life, through their social life, but it shouldn't be ever transferred over into their role as they're performing.
Yeah, I've got to be able to recognize that if somebody's rejecting me, they're not rejecting me as a person. They're rejecting the role I fill, so I don't take it personally. I have never been famous, but I can imagine if I were in the role of a famous actor, I would have a difficulty reading the critiques of my films, right? Because that's an example of taking it personally. If I take it personally, I may never act again. Because if there's a barrage of people that talk disparagingly about my movie, yet my movie sells, what does that tell you about the movie?
That's right. It's all about the critics, but the best actors in the world take those critiques seriously, because that's their performance in the role as that character was,
yes,
as opposed to taking that critique, as you said, as a personal ding on their character as a person. Because there's two separate things. Some of the best actors in the world play these roles that, frankly, I would never want to be with that person, that character that they're playing, because these roles that I would never invite them over for Thanksgiving dinner, but the individual I might, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Some of these wonderful performances on stage, when you peel the onion back and get to know the actor, that's someone you might not want to know.
Great point. Let's take one other topic, and that is one of our Sandler rules is you can't fail at prospecting unless you fail to prospect. And I think far too often, those of us in a business development role, of course, we like the low-hanging fruit when people reach out to us, but that might not be the best use of our time, nor it might not even be our ideal client. So we really want to get to a point where we're working proactively to find that target client. How do I get past my own beliefs or fear of failure to embrace prospecting, knowing that I'm going to have to fail and learn from failing?
Redefine failure as quitting. Redefine failure as quitting, in such that if you believe that you don't want to fail, then don't quit. Failure can be defined that way, and that's the way I would define it. For me, that's the way that my father defined it for me. You never quit, no matter what, never quit. You might find that you're not good at something or you don't like to do something. That doesn't mean that you quit. So how do you redefine it? It's a paradigm shift. And what I would say is there are expectations that I have of my own performance and my own development. You're exercising constantly. A golf game is won on a golf course in a golf tournament, but preparing for that is on the range. And you've got to be on the range all the time. You don't win every hole and you don't win every round, but you can win the year and you can win the tournament. And you do that by allowing yourself to continually challenge yourself to grow. In sales, you're either growing or you're failing. You're defeating. So the purpose is always find that next challenge that you can overcome. Otherwise, someone will overcome it before you do and begin to lead the pack. So as those calls get fearful, then what we have to do as managers is lay that safe zone and the expectation that you're always going to try something new, because I need you to define new barriers at a new level. Remember, training is only a step on a staircase of development. Learning happens along the way.
That's a great point. My guest today is Josh Seibert. Josh is the author of the book, Winning from Failing. Josh, give your contact information for our listeners, if you would, please.
Easiest way to get to know me and to get a hold of me is to go to my website, and that's training.sandler.com. That's training.sandler.com. You can get me that through the contact button on that site, and you can find my book in the shop, in the Sandler shop, connected to training.sandler.com.
This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. If you'd like to receive my weekly tip on how to jumpstart your professional development, sign up at crossroads.sandler.com. This is Sandler Training, where you find power in reinforcement. Welcome back to the Sandler Training Hour. I'm with Sandler trainer Josh Seibert. Now, Josh, Sandler is a trial and error, ongoing reinforcement that we all have to learn through. And I'd like you and I to walk through some of the frustrations, concerns, and challenges that we've had in learning through failure. I think that might be a great way to illustrate to our listeners that, number one, we're not exempt. We eat our own dog food. And number two, if you aren't failing, you aren't growing. So I'll lead off, Josh. I'll share one of my failures. You know, I got to confess here openly that I don't like managing people because I'm a very dominant person. And I find that I tend as a dominant person to tell people what to do instead of helping them discover what to do. And I default towards being efficient as opposed to effective. So when I first bought the Sandler franchise, I think I had 40 plus employees and I was a great teller. I was not a great manager. And it became so hard for me to overcome that. My Sandler coach at the time said to me, you know, Stevens, you need to set a goal for yourself because your problem is nobody likes you. I said, what do you mean nobody likes me? He said, I talked to you on the phone. I can tell people don't like you. You're just not very likable. You're too mean. I said, I beg to differ. I don't think so. He said, well, try this. Over the next week, I want you to set up a goal for yourself. Every day, I want you to give 5 surprise strokes to employees. Find 5 employees and go to them and tell them what a good job you're doing. And when we talk next week, we can see how good you are at this. And it was hilarious, Josh, because at the end of every day, I mean, it'd be 4:30, I'd be looking at that and thinking, holy crap, I haven't said one nice thing to anyone yet. And it wasn't until I had the pain of realizing, you know what, I am a jerk, that I had enough pain to change. So unpack that for us.
Wow, that one's a hard one to unpack, without a doubt. But, you know, it's that realization, you know, learning happens by failing. There's an example of it. We don't even believe that we're failing until we face failure and experience it. And then it's an aha moment.
Right. I would never have guessed it if I hadn't have been challenged. And I wouldn't have been challenged if I hadn't have bought a Sandler franchise and had a Sandler coach telling me. And of course, I learned growing up, you draw more flies with honey than vinegar, but I just wasn't self-aware to realize that my drive to achieve was actually driving people away.
Yes. You were using your critical parent, as they said.
That's right.
More so than your adult, your nurturing parent. And those ego states tend to take over, especially if we're in a corporate environment to where we climb that corporate ladder. Yeah. And over a lifetime, we believe that we're the admiral of a fleet when we're barely a plebe ensign. as we go along.
That's hilarious.
You know, I remember the time, Jim, when I got the opportunity. I was working with Prudential Financial. And in fact, in the book, Winning from Failing, I share this experience in there that I was a very successful salesperson in Charleston, South Carolina. I had my own agency and built it up to where I was pretty happy. How could you not be happy living in Charleston, South Carolina? The weather is great. The food is phenomenal. And after leaving the United States Submarine Navy and becoming a salesperson and in the life insurance business and financial services business. I had my own office. I had my own administrative staff and I had my own quasi small business. It was an agency. And for those out there that know what that world is, you recognize it. Well, of course, the more successful you are in corporate life, leadership tends to look at those successful salespeople to identify by factor, as it were. Mm-hmm. If you're performing well, you too could be a manager. You too could do that job as a sales manager. You know,
right.
You know the story, right? And as it were, I for the first time, I turned it down. The next time the brass ring came around again, I got to thinking, you know, I'm either going to spend my money by developing my personal agency by hiring more people, or I could spend Prudential's money and just use my talents and skills and do what my manager said, the leadership said, Josh, if you all you got to do, and those words are very, very dangerous for a new sales manager, Josh, all you got to do is show people what you're doing and you can't help but be successful. Well, I ignored all of the sales managers who had failed before me and asking the reasons why that they had failed and said, yes, I believe in myself and I too. If I can do it, anyone can do it.
Yeah.
So I snatched that brass ring. And of course, you get those opportunities, right? Right, Jim?
Yeah.
And the opportunity was to take this low performing team of salespeople and bring them to the top. So it only looks up. Out of 2,500 sales teams throughout the nation at the time, our team was somewhere around 1,800.
Wow.
So things looked kind of bright for me. How could I fail? 6 months later, this team of 12 salespeople at number 1,800, I had driven that thing to near 2,500. It was like 2,200 and something. And I was down to 7 salespeople. So very quickly, I learned that all you got to do wasn't all you got to do. And I certainly couldn't clone the Josh methodology of this. So it's a wake-up call. We always have those wake-up calls. And mine was, you know, I can't tell people what to do or just show them what to do. There's a difference between getting people to just know what I do, and it's as simple as that, actually performing and getting results through those other people. I had to learn very quickly, otherwise I would have failed miserably, catastrophically. Luckily, I was given the line to fail quickly so that I could fix it along the way.
Nice. And I think there's almost a principle there. We have to go down far enough that we finally hit the bottom and say, you know what? I have enough pain. I'm going to figure this out.
You know, all successful people tend to do that. I call it the square root of growth. You know, if you remember that square root symbol, if it's the only thing you remember in mathematics, it's a very good sign. We're on this plane and we really want to be up on this upper plane, but we got to go through the pain of that learning curve. And it's really that dip before we can actually sustain that other plateau.
I love that. So I have to get to that point of feeling the pain before I'm willing to take the risk to fail intentionally and start to change. So end that story for us. What did you recognize that was your biggest challenge that you had to turn around?
Well, one, it wasn't all you got to do. So there was more components to it. One, I recognized very quickly that I had to get some good raw material, those with the attitude necessary. And that was the A part of the triangle. I didn't know the A part of the triangle at the time until I came to Sandler to recognize it. But what I did recognize is that not everyone has the inner drive and the desire to be successful. So first I learned I had to have the right people on the bus and the right seats on the bus, those that had drive and desire. And secondly, they had to have a plan. They had to have a plan for success other than just all you got to do is do what I do and you'll be successful. They had to link that behavior side of the triangle with their goals and their plans and what they needed to do as opposed to what my plan was.
Nice.
And then last but not least, it began to work on the technical aspects of their talents and skills to be able to do that. And that was a tough part for me, to allow them to do it versus me just jump in there and rescue it for them. For them to discover, as you pointed out, Jim, was much more valuable than for me to tell them or to show them.
Yeah, and especially when you see them doing something different than the way you would do it. Everything in you wants to say, time out, that's not the right way. But in reality, it's very plausible that they figured out a better way. And perhaps if I keep my mouth shut and let them struggle, I might, heaven forbid, learn something.
Wow, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, there's so many different reasons for allowing that failure to happen because, you know, we all visualize their ship is sinking and I can go in and rescue that ship when in fact it's a submarine and they've devised for it to go down and to resurface and it's more powerful than it was before. But we don't recognize that.
What an awesome illustration. Josh Seibert's my guest today. Josh, thank you for your service to our country. He's the author of the book Winning from Failing. And give your contact information, Josh, in case one of our listeners would like to reach out to you.
Easiest way to reach out to me in North Carolina is through our website, training.sandler.com. If you simply go to training.sandler.com, you'll find out everything there is to know about us that I want you to know about us, as well as the ability to buy the book on the shop on that particular website. You'll find our book, Winning from Failing, along with a multitude of very valuable books that you can purchase through that site. And if you need to contact me through that site, very easily done. So training.sandler.com.
Thanks, Josh. Thank you so much, listeners, for inviting us into your world. I'm Jim Stevens, and my calling is to challenge people to resist the status quo. Are you frustrated because you're living with just good enough? Do you feel forced to accept chaos and volatility in daily business and customer relationships? Are you anxious by your career of trial and error, learning the hard way? If you're ready to stand up to the insanity of programmed living, call me at 208-429-9275. Have a great weekend, and remember, if you measure it, you'll manage it.